On a Thursday night, earlier this month, more than 200 people filled Knuckleheads in the East Bottoms. They grabbed cocktails and found their seats. It was all part of a storytelling event called Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. People shared stories about experiences they've had while on the road. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear true stories from that event, which was hosted by me. Tales of near-death experiences, being stranded in a foreign land, and how a beaver puppet saved a road trip gone horribly wrong. The evening started with a story by me. So, when I was 22 years old, I bought a plane ticket to Japan. That was no small thing. I was working a few different part-time jobs. To say it was the beginning of a journalism career might be an exaggeration. It was the thing that comes right before the beginning of a journalism career. And I didn't have a credit card because I had not figured out a lot about money, but I had figured out that I didn't have what it took to be trusted with a credit card. I had that much wisdom. So this was actually a really good idea, believe it or not, because I had a friend who was living in Japan. It was unlikely that very soon I would again just like have an opportunity to go to this other part of the world and be with someone who knew his way around, knew the language, could be my ambassador. So I bit the bullet, I got the ticket. It was his spring break, he taught English over there. And one little problem, he had miscalculated when his spring break was, so I actually didn't have a guide. I hadn't learned like any little phrases in Japanese because I had this fluent tour guide and hadn't looked up maps and charted my course. This was pre-cell phone. But it was fine, you know, like he gave me this little pointer that a lot of people in Japan do speak English but will tell you that they don't. And it's because they wish they spoke it better. And if you really have an emergency, someone can help you. I was uncomfortable with the idea of someone else having to help me in my language because I have an emergency and don't know my way around. So I filed that away, but was like, I'm not doing that. That's not going to happen. So I found my way around in a very like artsy Hansel and Gretel kind of way. I took a notebook with me everywhere, and when I turned, I drew a picture of something I saw so that I would know to turn the opposite way when I saw that thing again. Because the street signs in Japan were like unbelievably unhelpful to me. If you don't even know the alphabet, these are just lines. It was actually easier to draw things than to try and make sense of the street signs. But it worked. It totally worked. And then I had to get back to the airport. That's when it became a problem. Chris gave me instructions about the subways I was supposed to take to get to the airport to catch this international flight home. So I'm on the first train, and the conductor suddenly stops the train, comes back, starts saying things in Japanese, and everyone gets off. And I'm like, well, I don't know what's going on. So I try staying on the train. that didn't work. He said more things more loudly in Japanese, and I quickly understood what that meant without really understanding what that meant, that I needed to get off the train. So now I'm really kind of screwed. Like, you know, I have to catch this international flight. I can't read the maps in the subway station. I can't read the signs in the subway station. I can't speak the language to ask a question. And if I miss this flight, I'm just stranded with no credit card, no cell phone. I can't even figure out my way back to my friend's apartment, let alone how to get myself the money to buy a new plane ticket home if I miss this one. So I'm asking, do you speak English? Person after person is either shaking their head or just saying in English, no, I'm sorry. I don't speak English. I can't help you. And so Chris's observation that if it's an emergency, they'll speak English kind of comes back to me, and I recognize I need to communicate that it's an emergency. How do you communicate that it's an emergency?
in a universal language. And I'm here to tell you that what you do is you cry. I just understood in that moment that I had to cry. I had to will tears in a foreign subway station. Turns out, once I just even gave myself permission to cry, it was remarkably easy. So there I am sobbing in the subway station. First person comes up. That person, yes, I can speak English. Yes, I can take you to someone. Next person, yes, I know how to get to the airport. I understand what's happening. There's construction on the train track. It's been rerouted. Person after person now knows English. And I, unfortunately, can't stop crying now. I make it on the plane, but I've realized the sun might be setting on my years of summoning tears intentionally for help. So these storytellers are going to supply new ideas, helpful hints in emergency travel situations. First, let me introduce Marcel Desmarteau, who will show us that you could try going fast and not sleeping.
All right, so my story begins with a few months ago, my sister and I were set to take a two-week trip to Tokyo. We are going to visit my brother there who lives there, and there's a lot of preparations put into this. Months of preparation, planning, spent a lot of money on this trip, so it was very important. So 3 days before the trip, I decided to start packing, and first thing I do is go to try to find my passport. Looking through all my apartment with a headlamp on, I can't find it anywhere. So here I am, 60 hours away from our flight leaving for Tokyo, and I don't have a passport. Okay, great. So the next day, I call the passport services, figure out, you know, how do I get a passport in under 48 hours? What I can do, my only option, is I have to get myself to a passport agency to get one in person day of. Now, there's passport agencies in a lot of major cities, none of which are in Kansas City, conveniently. So I got to get myself to another city. Okay, so later that night, I'm trying to strategize and put things together in my head. How am I gonna do this, okay? And I realized not only do I need to get to another city tomorrow, I got to pull a 8-hour work shift at work tomorrow, because tomorrow's my last day before this vacation. I got to get my, I work in a kitchen, I got to get my kitchen staff all prepped up for 2 weeks of me being gone. So I decide, well, I mean, not sleeping tonight, so we'll forget about that. So it's 1 a.m, and I'm just going to go into work, and so here I am, T-minus 28 hours till Tokyo flight leaves for Kansas City. Going to work, and I'm just prepping away and keeping an eye on flights, you know, where I can go, what my options are. And it comes up to 5:30 in the morning. I see that basically my last option is a one-way flight to Houston that leaves at 6:30 a.m. So I book it immediately. I work in Overland Park, Kansas, and I got to get to the airport in 1 hour. So I just, luckily I brought all the information I needed for my passport with me, run out to the car, and I just hightail it to the airport. I get there in 25 minutes from Overland Park. I didn't even know that was possible, and I'm glad I didn't hit anybody out there. So I get on the Houston flight, get into Houston, get a cab, get to the agency. The agency is just packed. It looks like there's about 60 people in this room waiting ahead of me. And there's 15 windows. Looks like about 4 of them are being serviced right now. Excellent. Okay, so this is T-minus 20 hours till my Tokyo flight leaves. And they eventually call me up 2 hours later. And I go up, and I'm just frantic. Talk to the lady my situation, you know, and I need to know, like, can you get me this passport today? And my nerves are just running like a bullet train, and hers are not. She's like, well, it might be ready at 2:30. I'm like, what is that? Like, why won't it be ready at 2:30? What would happen? I need some, a little more reassurance. Well, like, sometimes our computers freeze up like they did a couple days ago. And people didn't get their passports on that day. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, then it should be ready. Awesome. Just the reassurance I was looking for. Okay, so my passport should be ready at 2:30. So I've got I got a few hours to kill in Houston. So I walk around aimlessly, and at this time, I book my flight back to Kansas City, which has to go through Atlanta. Yes. Okay. So I come back to get in line for my passport, 2:30, get up to the front. She has my passport. Yes! I go and catch a free bus all the way to the airport. I board my flight, feeling pretty good, got my passport, T-minus 15 hours till my flight leaves. Now my flight is set to get into Atlanta at 9:30 p.m., and this, my connecting flight to Kansas City is set to leave at 10:15. I only have a 45-minute leeway, not a whole lot of time. So I'm sitting there in 5:45, and they tell us that there's some weather issues in Atlanta. It's going to run about 15 minutes late. Okay, 15 turns into 30, 30 turns into 45. Holy crap, I'm going to miss my connecting flight. They allow me to get off the flight and see what my options are with the front desk lady. So I go out, talk to her. Do you have any other direct flights to Kansas City? Any other airlines? No, she doesn't. Do you have anything to St. Louis, Omaha? She's got one to Omaha. Okay, how can I get from Omaha to Kansas City tonight? So she, at this point, she's looking at me. The Atlanta flight is getting ready to leave. It's ready to leave now. They're literally waiting on me to board this flight. She's got her finger on the button. Are you going to get on this flight, or do you want me to book Omaha? Screw it. Let's go Omaha. I cannot get stuck in Atlanta tonight, so I'm going to Omaha now. How the hell am I going to get to Kansas City from Omaha? We put so much planning in this trip and so much money, and I'm not going to be able to rebuy another ticket if I miss that Tokyo flight. Like, if I get stuck in Omaha, I'll be so just embarrassed that I missed this trip. I might just stay in Omaha and just make a life there. I don't know. But come on, snap out of it. Who can get you back to Omaha? Who can get you back to Kansas City? And I think of my friend Steph. Steph is just a down-for-whatever kind of friend. And I text her, you know, hey, you want to take a road trip tonight? Ha, 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 ha. I call her. I'm like, no, I'm for real. Like, can you pick me up at 11 o'clock tonight from Omaha? And we drive back to Kansas City. Yes, she's in. Steph is just down for whatever. So, okay. So this is T-minus 12 hours before Tokyo flight leaves. I get to Omaha at 11 p.m. Steph's right there, right on time to pick me up. Drive all the way back to Kansas City. She drops me off at my car at the airport. I pick up my car, drive home. At this point, it's 3 a.m. in the morning. T-minus 3 hours till Tokyo flight leaves. I haven't had sleep in over 48 hours at this point. And my sister's due to pick me up for the airport to go right back to the airport in about 90 minutes. And I look at the couch, and before I even think about sitting down and passing out, I just start going to the bedroom, start packing frantically for a two-week trip. Start packing, shower, shave, and eat breakfast with 10 minutes to spare before my sister gets there. She picks me up, T-minus 90 minutes to our Tokyo flight leaves. We drive to the airport, T-minus 3, 2, 1. Tokyo flight is leaving, and we are on it! For the best Tokyo trip ever. Thank you.
Next up, we've got Matthew Long Middleton, who reminds us to research the worst case scenario before it actually happens, because it will. Matthew Long Middleton, producer of Central Standard.
All right. I woke up suddenly, jolted awake by the sound of roaring rain and thunder, and I knew immediately I was in very serious danger. But to set that scene, what had gotten me into that predicament was in the Spring of 2011, I had decided to bicycle solo across the country. That was precipitated by, in 2010, the fall, I had lost my job. You don't like lose a job like a pair of keys, like I got laid off. So I lost my job, and I had been wanting to do this for a very long time. I've been wanting to bicycle across the United States for a number of reasons. I've always loved the crap out of this country. I was an American studies major. There's just something about it. It's the most bizarre place on earth, in 50 little states all connected together. I also, like I think everybody, had a sneaking suspicion that I was special and exceptional and was looking for a way to prove that. And so I decided to bike from Charleston, South Carolina, all the way over to San Diego, California. And this is the spring of 2011. And you may or may not remember this, but this was in this year, I encountered the worst tornadoes in a century in Alabama that killed 230 people in one day. I then encountered the worst flooding on the Mississippi River in over a century. And then when I got to Oklahoma, Texas, the worst drought in recorded state history of Texas, and then the worst forest fire in the state of Arizona in its history. So I was hitting on all cylinders. So I was living in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn, and I took Amtrak down to Charleston, and I came across, you know, started my bike tour. So when I was in Alabama and those tornadoes I was mentioning, I just had no sense of what was going on. And I mean, like, they were really serious tornadoes. And at the time, I discovered that a building makes a really interesting noise when you're, like, really in a bad situation. If you remember elementary school and, like, the steel desks when they lost the felt bottoms and you would drag them across the tile floor, that, like, it's like the whole building, shh. Like, it makes this incredibly harsh noise, and it really, really does sound like a freight train. It really, really does. And I had heard that at the time. Because I was, like, getting freaked out when I was in Alabama, and I had on my helmet, because I had read that that's a safe thing to do. Because the thing that kills you is usually something smacking you in the head. So I was like, that makes sense. So I've been starting to do research on tornadoes because I never experienced them in the Northeast where I grew up. And then I got to Clarksville, Arkansas, day 53. And that night I knew there was bad weather. And, you know, there were potential tornado generating storms in Oklahoma. And they were kind of headed up this way. So I decided I wasn't going to camp that night. I was going to stay at a cheap motel. So I did that. But I also made a decision that I would go to sleep, because if there are no storms and I stay up till 2 in the morning just waiting for bad things to happen to me, I'm not sure, you know, I'll get the opportunity, you know, to ride the next day. And that's when I woke up in the middle of the night and I knew, like, instantly I need to get into a bathtub. Like, not even, I mean, it was... I grabbed my cell phone and the pillow, and I jumped into the tub. And I'm taller, so, like, getting into the fetal position in a tub is kind of like, it's like, well, which limb do I want to lose, my shoulder or my knee? But it's very cold in the tub. And I mean, it was 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, boom. And, like, I knew something had happened to the building because I started to get wet. So I'm like, well, the roof has been compromised in some way, but I didn't know in what way. I also didn't know at the end of a tornado if there's, like, another one behind it, you know, like could there be multiple tornadoes coming your way? I just had no idea. And so I stayed in the tub for probably an embarrassingly long time. And I opened up the door, like, there's no light on, like, we lost power. And then there's a flash of lightning. And I know that because it illuminates the entire room. We had it had taken off the ceiling, it had taken off the roof, and everything was just gone. And, like, on my bed, there was debris where I was sleeping just seconds ago. That was, like, a really illuminating moment. You know, I call my girlfriend and I leave her a voicemail, and then I call my folks, and they actually wake up, and I tell them I'm okay, and I start to, like, you know, cry, and I don't, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I think the reason looking back on that was, like, you know, it was probably the closest I've ever come to, like, a near-death experience. And it's like, it's not, it's knowing that you are lucky to know that you could not know anything right now. Like, you could be gone. Like, that's the experience. Like, oh, I'm so lucky to realize I'm nothing. Like, that, it's like an incredibly humbling experience. The whole thing about this is, I think that we tell ourselves this narrative that with near-death experiences, that they can change your life. I feel like it's a bit of a cliche. Like, oh, I beat cancer, totally changed my life. I don't take anything for granted. I overcame addiction. I don't take anything for granted. Changed my life. I'm a much better person. I don't know if it's done that to me. I don't know if it's like, you know, this feeling of gratitude you're supposed to feel, or like fear of death, being so close to it. But I know that for me, I still had goals I wanted to accomplish. And sometimes the only thing you can do is just get up in the next morning and get on that bicycle and head out towards the setting sun. Thank you all.
That was producer Matthew Long Middleton for KCUR's Central Standard, speaking at a storytelling event that took place earlier this month. The theme was planes, trains, and automobiles. More stories up ahead. I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's get back to the storytelling event that I hosted a few weeks ago as a benefit for Generation Listen KC.
Our next storyteller is Hector Casanova, from whom we learn the ever-important lesson, make a friend.
Yes, this is definitely a story about friendship. Specifically, friendship with ducks, and how I got the best advice of my life from a duck. I have to backtrack a little bit and give you a little bit of background information to set up how you can reach enlightenment from waterfowl. I was born and I grew up in Mexico City. When I was 14 years old, my stepfather was offered a position at the University of Pittsburgh. So then all of a sudden, we had this option to come to America. My mother, my sister, and I, we all four of us came to the United States with student visas. There was a public school that was an art magnet school in Pittsburgh, and I was studying art. And it was awesome. It was the American dream all of a sudden. So while I was in high school, I got a girlfriend, which was a gigantic accomplishment on my behalf. And her family had been planning a family trip to Germany for years and years and years. By the time they were really kind of like getting ready to go on this trip, my girlfriend, whose name was Joy, she didn't want to go because she did not want to spend a significant chunk of her summer hanging out with her parents in Germany when she could just be hanging out with me. So they worked out a compromise that they should bring me along to Germany. I declined. It was much too much. I didn't even know how to respond to such an offer of generosity. So I declined, but she wouldn't go, so they insisted. So eventually, I was very flattered, and I said yes. I contacted the Mexican consulate to make sure that this would be okay. I'm here on a student visa. I'm going to be traveling abroad. Any problems? They said no problem. So we went. We went to Germany. I should also mention at this point that this was 1993, or as I prefer to call it, year one BI, before the internet. This also becomes really relevant. So we went to Germany. Germany was beautiful. We traveled all over Germany. I forgot to mention one fact. Before the trip, right before the trip, about 2 weeks before the trip, Joy and I broke up. But we broke up, and I was just freshly 18 at the time. And we realized, you know, we were being adults about this. We were better friends than lovers. We should see this trip as the first stage of our new life as best friends, right? It was too late to call off the trip. In fact, it was kind of awkward, so we shouldn't tell her parents. So we just proceeded as friends, And I'm really happy to report that the trip itself, we did that. We actually had a great friend. It was like a road trip movie. It was great. We had a great trip as friends. And then it was time to come home. We got to the airport 3 hours before the flight departs because her family believes in following those kind of rules. And we are getting ready for, you know, we're doing the check-in, and they get through. It's fine. They're all American citizens. I'm not. When the ticket agent looks at my paperwork, he tells me that something is amiss, that I can't get on the plane. I'm missing a stamp on my passport. So I say, okay, no problem. The Germans are renowned for their efficiency. You guys go on ahead, get on the plane. I'm gonna take the subway to the American consulate. I'm sure that this can be figured out really quickly. I'll be back in time to catch the plane. I left the airport, I got on the subway, I made it to the American consulate two stops over. As soon as I got to the front of the line, I was interviewed by this German consular. He asked me basic questions. I was very forthright. Yes, I am a Mexican citizen. Yes, I'm in the United States on a student visa. Yes, I do have family in the United States, my mother, my sister, and my stepfather, all of whom are on student visas. Yes, I am traveling with my girlfriend. She's an American citizen. And as soon as I finished this brief interview, he basically just looked at me and he put his hands together and he said, you are screwed. And then he proceeded to write a code on my passport, 214B. If you have ever seen this code on your passport, you are not here. In fact, you are banned from the United States. Apparently because of having family in the United States, because of having a romantic relationship with an American woman, I was now no longer eligible for a student visa because I had too high a risk to immigrate. So I was banned. So after he explained this to me, I said to the German consular, okay, so if I understand this correctly, you have just effectively made me homeless and left me stranded in Germany, what would you do in my place? And he looked at me and he said, go back home, meet nice girl, make a new life. Next. 214B also means that you cannot even go over American airspace. And I found out that in order to get back to Mexico, there's only one flight that goes from Frankfurt to Mexico without going over American airspace on Sundays, once a week. So I had a lot of time to kill. I didn't really know what to do. I should mention that I had all of my baggage, all of my luggage, everything was on a plane to the United States. The only thing that I have with me was a backpack full of art books, about 50 pounds of museum catalogs, a pocket full of Deutschmarks, and luckily, a credit card. I had just had my very first adult credit card that I had got just a few months before. And that was just everything that I owned on the world. So I went to a German McDonald's. I bought some French fries on credit. And one of the few things that you can do for free when you're homeless and stranded in a foreign country is go to the zoo. I just sat down by a lake, and it was the first time in my life when I literally, honest to goodness, had no idea what was going to happen next. And I just broke down crying. And then all of a sudden, just out of over there, I just hear this like, whack. Like, whack, whack. So I look over, and there's this big duck right there, just standing right there. And this duck was clearly talking to me. And he didn't speak German, and neither did I. And for the first time, it did not matter. And he told me his story, and which really meant he wanted French fries. And I told him mine, and it's hard to describe. how you can all of a sudden just be best friends with a dog, but I was. I fed him French fries, and he quacked, and he was so chipper. One detail that I forgot to mention about this duck is that he was messed up. But, like, seriously messed up. He had, like, he was missing feathers on the top of his head. He had kind of, like, crusty blood. It was clear that he had had a really bad day. Arguably worse day than I. And the fact that he was so chipper and so willing to put that behind him and instead just talk to me about French fries, I realized that if this duck can just kind of shrug all this off, so can I. So I mentioned this is the year before, year one before the internet. All I could do was basically buy a phone card and make phone calls. And through a bunch of phone calls and research and just killing time, I eventually figured out that the only thing that I could do to get back to the United States to be with my mother and sister was to get married. So Joy, bless her heart, really the best friend anybody could ever ask for, said, sure, let's get married. We're adults. We can do this. So we filed for the paperwork. I flew back to Mexico. That Sunday came around. I flew to Mexico. I rented a little room in an apartment. It was about a three-month wait, but the paperwork eventually cleared. It was very specific, by the way. It specified that I could only come back into the United States on a very specific bridge in a very specific city in Ciudad Juarez, crossing by foot, present the paperwork, and then I could come back to the States. So from Mexico, I took a bus to Ciudad Juarez, took a cab to the bridge, crossed by foot, turned in the paperwork, made it into El Paso, and then took a flight to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And a week later, I was married. Our invitations read, "The Immigration and Naturalization Service cordially invites you to the wedding of..." And that's how I got to stick around. So, thank you.
That's artist Hector Casanova, whose murals you've heard about on KCUR's Central Standard. His story was part of an event at Knuckleheads. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to take a quick break. Be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been listening to stories about the crazy things that happen when you travel. This is all from a storytelling event that I hosted for Generation Listen KC. The theme was planes, trains, and automobiles. Our next storyteller is Megan Coleman, and from her, we learn, just enhance the mood.
So this last summer, my younger sister and I went on a 17-day, nearly 5,000-mile road trip across the West and Southwest, where we camped in 9 different national parks and stayed in a few cities along the way. Now, we tried to cram as much as possible into this trip, which meant that on any given day, we averaged about 8 to 10 hours in the car. Growing up, my sister and I used to go on lots of family road trips with my parents, where they would throw us in the back of the family station wagon with one Game Boy between the two of us, because they are sadists. So we had a lot of experience with road trips, but we hadn't gone on one together in almost 20 years, and never just the two of us. So on our third night, we camped in Arches National Park, and that next morning we woke up at 4 a.m. to hike to Delicate Arch to see the sunrise. So we did that. We hiked for a few hours, and then we had an 11-hour drive ahead of us to get across Utah and Nevada. Now, to cross Nevada, we took Highway 50, which is nicknamed the loneliest highway, and that is no accident. It is the most desolate, isolated, miserable stretch of road I have ever experienced in my life. And for that reason, we kept the air conditioning to an absolute minimum because I was afraid that the car was going to overheat. And I should also mention that my rule is whoever does the driving gets to pick the music. So this meant my sister was subjected to 11 hours in a hot car with me singing along to In Excess the whole time. I don't think she liked it as much. So that night, we stayed in a bizarre little town called Tonopah, Nevada, and the next morning, we woke up and drove to Yosemite. Now, for me, this was the pinnacle of the trip. It was by far the hardest campsite to secure, and prior to going on this trip, I had downloaded an app called Tinder. For dating. My thinking was that I was gonna go to Yosemite and meet some like hot bearded climber guy and take him back to the tent and have my way with him. Well, my sister wasn't really too thrilled with this idea because we were sharing a tent. So when we finally got down to the valley to our campsite, she and I pitched the tent, put everything else in the bear box, and immediately stopped speaking to each other. We had both had enough. The hot car, the long days, her listening to me singing along to new wave music for hours on end, and talking about bearded strangers I planned to take advantage of. And she kind of knew how to push my buttons, too. So the awkward silence lasted about 30 minutes, and then we both decided, okay, we've got 2 more weeks. We can't do this for another 2 weeks without talking to each other. So we made sort of like a sister pact that we would do whatever it took to get along for the rest of the trip. That night, we ate pizza, drank beer, and hiked around Yosemite and had a spectacular time. The next morning, we woke up and drove to San Francisco. Now, that is where I had my one and only Tinder date of the experience, with a guy who talked about George Lucas for 2 hours. Fortunately, I had a friend who lived in San Francisco, and he rescued me from that date, and he and I ended up hooking up that night. And my sister had to find somewhere else to stay. So that sister pact was immediately put to the test, and she passed with flying colors. She is a saint, and I am an The morning that we left San Francisco, that friend of mine treated my sister and I to breakfast, and then left us with a parting gift of some fancy coffee and an adult cigarette. So we drove. Okay. So we drove through the Sierras that day and in and out of Kings Canyon National Park, which there are these serpentine windy roads that take you through the canyon. And then it takes you to Sequoia, where it was where we were going to be camping that night. Now, as we turned around this steep curve in the road, something leapt over the roadway right in front of the car and disappeared on the other side of the road into the forest. At the time, we weren't sure, was this a wolf or just the biggest coyote we'd ever seen? It turns out it was a coyote. But at that moment, we looked at each other and said, all right, this place is wild. If we see anything crazy here, this is where it's going to happen. So we get down to our campsite, pitch the tent, put everything in the bear box, and then head out for a hike together. We get a few hundred feet up on the trail and decide, let's do some sisterly bonding. So we get that joint out, and just as she was about to light it, I noticed that up ahead on the trail, in my peripheral vision, I see this black dog wandering around. And then it occurs to me that there are no loose dogs in these parks. I throw my arm out and stop her dead in her tracks, and I say, bear, holy shit, bear. Sure enough, up ahead of us was a black bear cub. So she and I, being the millennial Generation Y types, already had our phones in our hands, so of course we snap a few pictures, because we're idiots. So we snap a few photos, and then we look at each other and say, oh God, what do we do? I'd forgotten everything I had read about what you do if there's a bear encounter. Fortunately, she wasn't as absent-minded as I was, and she said, we're supposed to make, I think, like a whole lot of noise. So we turn around and head back down the trail as quickly and loudly as we could, because we knew baby bears aren't alone. Mama bear was out there somewhere. We just hadn't run into her yet. So we get as far away from the bears as we felt comfortable, and yet still far enough away from the campsite that we had some privacy, and we smoked that joint. And I tell you, I've never been so paranoid in my life as when I was getting high thinking two bears were watching me. The next morning we woke up, we drove to Vegas and stayed there that night, and the 5 final nights of the trip, we went to back-to-back parks. We stayed in Grand Canyon, then Zion, then Bryce, then Mesa Verde, and our final night, we stayed in the Great Sand Dunes. So we get to our campsite, pitch the tent, put everything in the bear box, and in the 10 minutes it took to do that, we went through a bottle and a half of DEET. So that night, we had an itchy night of sleeping, or not so much sleeping, woke up the next morning and had an 11-hour itchy drive back across Colorado and Kansas to get back to KC. That night, as I was sitting in my apartment, exhausted, I was reminiscing over those 17 days, and it had occurred to me that in that time, I had experienced the most awkward adult date of my life, the least relaxing adult cigarette of my life, and the most fantastic adult camping trip of my life. Thank you.
Next up is Will Averill, the founder of the website You, I'm from Kansas. And from him we learn, know your audience.
There comes a point in your life where you're stuck in Spokane, Washington, and the only thing between you and ever getting back to Kansas is a stuffed beaver puppet. Whoa. Exterior, the late 90s. All right, thank you. Yeah, you remember that too. It was a good time. Two boys from Kansas in a truck headed up to Vancouver on a quest. Anyway, we decided to head up because I was desperately in love with a woman that I'd met over the internet. So the two of us went up with just a little bit of gear. We had $1,500. Gas was at an all-time high at $2.15 a gallon. We get to Vancouver. I have two wonderful days abandoning him, stealing his truck, and wandering around Beaver Lake with this lady who I did end up marrying eventually. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Thanks. We're divorced now. So that happened. But anyway, we have two wonderful days, and we start home, and we realize we have a problem. We only have $300, and we have got to get back to Kansas in 2 days. All right, we plan it. We realize, too, that gas is only 79 cents in Canada. So we come up with a cunning plan to travel all the way across the north of Canada, cut down Montana, all the way back down to Kansas, thus eliminating most of the east coast part of the west coast part of the trip. We get to the first gas station and we realize it comes out to more than it would in the States because they charge by the liter and not the gallon. Yeah. We turn around and we head back to Spokane, Washington. We have $300 left and not a lot of time to get there when the alternator light comes on. We pull over. Spokane is the nearest place. We walked across the street to the mechanic store where my friend Amon was able to get an alternator, which was the problem, and get it fixed. The only problem was the alternator cost $300. This leaves us with an issue. We go to the money tree. We don't have any credit cards because who would give us credit cards in the 90s? And one thing we do have is a checkbook from my theater company, Card Table Theater. Now, one reason that my relationship with this woman might not have worked out was because I am, in fact, a 40-year-old puppeteer, not something that many women find as an exciting or bankable career. My father was a children's theater impresario, and every time he would go on a trip, he would buy me a hand puppet. I would do puppet shows for him and his friends, and they would think I was hilarious, and I thought it was because I was a comic genius, but it turns out because they were mostly high. But in college, we were going to do a pretentious voice music piece, and we decided on top of that to go with that, we'd do puppet theater. So it became our adult entertainment mecca, and I thought going to Vancouver to meet a woman I met over the internet who is British and traveling with her auntie, because that is what British women do, I should take some puppets to show her. I should show her what I do. So I take them. I take them. And we have them now, and I walk into the money tree, and I asked to cash the Card Table Theater check. And they say, well, you're not on the check. We can't do this. It's three kind of middle-aged, kind of fruffy women, the kind that they breed in Spokane, Washington. And she's like, you know, we can't do anything with this. I was like, well, we are the artistic directors. Our name doesn't need to be on the check. We can just do this. She's like, well, is it good? And we said, well, it will be, if you just give us enough time and cash the check. So they end up calling our friend Jerry, who's like, oh, I know those guys. Yeah, don't cash that check. Which doesn't really help us. We managed to convince her he was kidding. But in this, the pleas get more and more desperate. I'm like, we were on a mission. I'm in love. I'm part of a theater company. We have been touring around to schools performing for children. And this is what we do. And she's like, and I'm like, is there anything I can bring in? Anything. I can bring the puppets in. And she says, okay, do it. So I go out to the car where Jeremy is sitting there chewing on a sandwich because he won't go into the money tree. And I say, I've got to have these puppets. And he just starts laughing, bits of Subway spitting out of his mouth at the hilarity of me trying to get away with this. I go in, I get the puppets, I take them back, and I pull out a few of them, some of the better looking ones. But, you know, there are slightly cuter ones like little Bobby here that could potentially have been at a children's show, albeit one that deals with themes of, you know, political and satirical fashion. So I pull that one out. She doesn't seem impressed. Pull another one out. She doesn't seem impressed. Finally, I pull out a big stuffed beaver, and she kind of smiles. And I say, here, I am part of a children's theater company. Here is my ID. Here is this beaver puppet. Will you please cash this $300 check? She says, I need to talk to my manager. I say, okay. She's like, can you slide it over? I'm like, okay. So I slide the stuffed beaver puppet underneath the bulletproof glass, and I swear I can see a snicker in this lady's eye, right? But she is playing it so straight, and I have no other option. Slide it under there. She takes it, and she's like, I'll just go check with the manager. Walks into the back room. I can only hear so much because the glass is pretty soundproof in addition to being bulletproof. But I swear I can hear a vague giggling and tittering. About 10 minutes go by. The guy behind me in line is just staring at me like, I don't know what your deal is, but I wouldn't do this for you in a million years. She comes back and she says, we'll cash it. And we managed to make it back just in time for the next puppet show. Sometimes in life, the only thing between you and a long time in Spokane is a stuffed beaver. Thank you very much.
Our next storyteller is Priscilla Howe. She might give you the sense that you just shouldn't listen to your parents.
My mother was afraid I'd get abducted. 1983, I left Vermont for Bulgaria for a year. I had a photocopy of a telegram that said I could go to Sofia, Bulgaria to study the language for 10 months. I would have a room and there would be a stipend. I had no idea how much the stipend would be, but I said to my mother, I got a plan. Yeah, it's fine. I have $947. I'm gonna go till it runs out. Yeah, I know it's a communist country. Yeah, it's behind the Iron Curtain, repressive regime. Yeah, yeah. So, she was kind of worried. But when I left, I wrote in my journal, Mom and Dad seemed sad to see me go and maybe a little jealous. And I hadn't realized that I was gonna arrive at 1 a.m. on Saturday morning on a train. I had no one to meet me. I had no Bulgarian money. I had no idea where I was going. So I was talking to a guy in the compartment, kind of a seedy-looking guy, with a gold tooth and a cast in his eye. He was talking to me in German. I don't speak German. I was talking to him in Russian. But I did understand that he said, come home with me. Normally, I would have said, oh, no, thank you very much. But I had been on the train for 3 days. And I was exhausted, and I had all my stuff for a year. And I said, okay. So we got in the cab, and we went to the housing development called Lulin. And in the cab, on the way to Lulin, I was thinking, what am I gonna do? Can I jump out? Can I jump out? What am I gonna do? Was Mom gonna be right? So we got to the apartment. We went up into this building, and we went up in the elevator to the fourth floor. And then Roman, his name was Roman, rang the doorbell, and his wife was standing there. His two children got out of bed. His father got out of bed. And we all sat in their tiny kitchen, at their tiny kitchen table, eating a delicious stew with thick slices of bread.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked.
So this is the last you'll hear from me. We're going to hear our last story, and then just have a great night. Thank you all so much for coming. And in case you're wondering about this guitar, our last storyteller is Barclay Martin, and he leaves us with the advice to bring a guitar.
For 10 years, I've made my living as a singer and songwriter, a musician, making records, playing concerts and traveling. And a few years ago, I was invited by an international nonprofit based here in Kansas City called Unbound to help them produce a concert, a celebration of peace, in one of the most notoriously dangerous regions of the southern Philippines. The assignment was simple: to put together the celebration for the community and by the community, and to get to know the people who were going to build it. I had to go there and spend some time. So one morning, we're in Zamboanga City, and Zamboanga is located at the very southern region of the Philippines as the spray of islands stretches towards Indonesia. And we got a call from the Bishop of Basilan. And Basilan is an island just south of Zamboanga and has one of the most notorious histories of rebel insurgencies. He said, "This particular moment is safe enough for you to be able to come as foreigners, and I will do everything I can to ensure your safety." So this following morning, we left early from the port in a small boat with just a handful of social workers that serve the community that we work with there. And I remember thinking about all the stories that have taken place and the shroud of violence that has hovered over this part of the world for generations. And we got to shore, and the bishop was true to his word, and we were met by 20 soldiers in combat fatigues, each of them carrying an M16, and we headed for the center of the island. And there we spoke with people, hearing about sieges of hospitals and of schools, bombings, beheadings, generations of violence, and amidst all of this, beautiful human beings that are raising their families. As we went deeper into the island, they doubled our reinforcement. 20 more soldiers joined us. We are now on a convoy of 40. Before we left to pick up the other 20 soldiers, I thought to myself, I am a folk singer. What am I doing here? And I got word that just 3 weeks later, in Basilan, on those same roads, in that same convoy, a rebel insurgency had encountered them on the road, thrown a grenade into the pack and killed several of them on the same roads we'd been traveling. So close. We made it back to the mainland, and we started building this concert. So they went to work on this field. They cleared it. They took the bramble and brush, cut it down with machetes, built this stage from the ground up. This was an outdoor concert, and there was absolutely no way we could ensure the safety of people, and so we could not advertise this concert. No one could know about it in a public sphere, and so we had to reach out to our community, the mothers' groups, and the social workers, to send messages out one by one to tell people that something beautiful and uniquely theirs was coming to their home. Most of the people that were building this had never even been to a concert. So how would we ensure the safety? Would it even happen? Would the families that we wanted to celebrate even be able to make it? So we made our way to the concert site, and the stage was built. There were decorations leading along this crazy and rough road to this place. When we reached the concert site, there were 10,000 people standing there with their families and their kids, there to celebrate their culture, their history, and their community. For one day of their lives, they got the opportunity to celebrate who they are and what they're capable of. And for a single day, things were peaceful.
Can you hear the song of children all around? And the messages of mercy still resound. A mother's prayer suspends the air.
Can you hear the song of children all around?
Barclay Martin, everyone. His story was part of a storytelling event earlier this month, which we've been sharing with you this Thanksgiving weekend in honor of all that traveling you and yours may be doing over the holidays. The stories were all in keeping with the theme planes, trains, and automobiles. Listen back to any stories you may have missed on our website, kcur.org/centralstandard. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. We had help from Matt Hodapp and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend, and stick around for a seasonal special on KCUR.